Good evening, ladies and gents. I know the speakers are trying to escape already. Welcome, my name is Matthew Horton. I'm Head of Alumni Relations here at the LSE, and I'd like to welcome you this evening to the ninth of our city events, entitled Internationalisation of Real Estate Markets, Synchronised Cycles or Collapsing Bubbles. I think it's going to be, as ever, a fairly lively debate, and I'd like to remind you that following a lively debate there is an opportunity for you to come along to a reception and drinks and nibbles in the atrium, which is outside of the old theatre and to the left, and there will be stewards directing you as we finish. I shan't introduce the panel, I shall leave that to our chair, but I shall introduce the chair to you this evening. And Paul Cheshire, Professor of Economic Geography in the Department of Geography and the Environment. An economist by training, he was previously Professor of Urban and Regional Economics at the University of Reading, and his research focuses generally on urban land and housing markets, the economics of planning, and European urban and regional development. He's widely published, and in 2002 was elected as Vice President of the European Regional Science Association. Apart from his academic work, he has spent a great time as an advisor and a consultant to the European Commission, the World Bank, the United Nations, and lots of other international organisations, including the British government. I'd like to thank him for his time tonight and pass over to him. Mr. Cheshire.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Is this all right, Mike? Yes. Much more fulsome introduction than I'm planning to give the speakers, I have to say. But anyway, welcome. It's very nice to see so many people here. Now, I think, looking around, I can recognise some faces from the real estate programme here at LSE, but I think most of you probably are not, and may not even know that we have a real estate programme here at LSE. So just to sort of get things going, how many of you either are graduates of or current students in the Real Estate Economics and Finance programme? So it's a pretty small group, but welcome, nice to see you back, or indeed I recognise you as a current student. But just for information, I mean, we've had a rapidly growing and flourishing master's course in real estate economics and finance here at LSE, based in the Geography and Environment Department, but including contributions from accounting and finance and from economics since 1998. And it's one of the most heavily subscribed master's programs in the school now, which is very nice for us to be involved with. Since the beginning, it's still nominally a pretty small program. It's only supposed to have 17 students a year, but this year we've got 26 and a half students because of the combination of the overwhelming number of applications and their sheer quality. So there's some good graduates that we're turning out. And a positive announcement in that context is that we just heard last week that we've got a donation to the school to establish a PhD scholarship for PhD students at quite a generous level who want to do research on real estate related issues, economics and finance. Now, given the career opportunities in real estate, which are very attractive, there is a real danger that the sort of academic quality will get eroded over time. So it's really important to have PhD students. And from 2007, and we have PhD students already, but you need the funding to support them. So it's very nice that we've got this coming into the school to support research in real estate and for the future sort of renewal of the academic cadre. Anyway, the topic that we're debating or discussing tonight, I should say that I suggested the general principles of the topic, but it sort of got sexed up in the alumni relations department, so it's slightly more succinct, shall we say, as it's arrived here. But it does reflect the underlying philosophy of our course, which was that real estate was an asset, an investment asset, which should be looked at as an investment asset in a wider world of investment assets. That it wasn't something that simply inhabited some walled enclosure called real property that had no relation to other investment assets. And I think that has important academic implications. It's the sort of basic approach that underpins our course. But of course, and this topic that we're discussing is, reflects this, it's also had huge implications for the investment and real estate world over the last 25 years, because in practical terms, what we've seen is this coming into reality as real estate has become part of the investment asset world. And we've seen the huge growth of specialist management firms over the last probably 25 years. I suppose they started in the States, but only over the last 10 years or so in Europe. We've had an astonishing internationalization of the market. One of the characteristics of real estate as an investment class until extraordinarily recently, I'm old enough to remember this, until extraordinarily recently in my professional career, it was a sort of basically parochial national event. And it's only over the last 15 years really that it's come to be an international class of investment assets. And that's been particularly true in the European context. But of course, one of the attractions of real estate as an investment asset is the diversification it brings. And one of the potential sources of diversification is international diversification in markets which have different real estate cycles. So one of the paradoxes is, of course, that the internationalization of the market may itself be one of the forces leading to convergence of international real estate markets, reducing, therefore, some of the diversification benefits that possibly come with internationalization of real estate portfolios. And there is evidence from the European experience that there has apparently been some convergence of cycles. If you look, if you compare the cycle of the late 1980s with the cycle that we've been observing over the last 5 years or so, where there's been a greater synchronization apparently over the last in the most recent cycle. Now, those of you who are doing the real estate economics and finance master's course, we'll know that Christian Hilber, who's sitting over there, who's the current course director, sitting next to one of last year's graduates, as I see, and I are somewhat suspicious of the term bubbles. It seems more suitable for headlines and hype than it does for objective analysis. But there you are. It's something that people like to talk about, and it's it does relate to another characteristic of real estate, that we can think of it, and the course is founded, our research is founded on thinking of real estate as simply one of a class, a world of investment assets. But at the same time, and equally central to our thinking, is the realization that real estate as an investment asset is unique, and it's unique because real estate is itself a factor of production, or, and the form of housing, enters directly into people's utility. They buy it because they want to live in it, or they occupy it because it's beneficial for their ability to generate profits. So that the demand for real estate assets, and ultimately its price and the return that an investor gets from it, always has to bear some relation to the underpinnings in the real economy which ultimately generate the demand for real estate. So in that way, the price of real estate assets and the returns you get from them have a different sort of relationship to the real economy than is necessarily the case of purely financial assets. Now, we don't offer answers. I carefully phrased this, so these are interesting questions, but we're not offering here to answer them. We're offering informed, I hope informed, crystal ball gazing, and we hope that you, as the audience, will be contributing to that crystal ball gazing, and particularly to the information. But we've got two excellent speakers to introduce the topic, both alumni of LSE, but neither of them alumni of the Real Estate Economics and Finance Programme. On the one hand, we've got Chris Parry on my right, who's partner with Patron Capital, and has been working with LSE over the last several years, helping our program develop and making contacts, and also working directly with the LSE real estate side. And then we've got Brian Southergill, who's Vice President of Morgan Stanley Investment Banking, which of course is one of the biggest players of all in the global internationalization of real estate investment. And Brian, I think, is sort of the embodiment of this internationalization. I think we're just catching him passing through London on his way to Hong Kong, if I've understood correctly. So very grateful to both of our speakers, and over to Chris, who's going to open the discussion.
Good evening. Well, Patron Capital, it's very important, these topics for Patron Capital, internationalization of real estate. Is there a global bubble? And are cycles, are they synchronized? These are very important questions. On the first point, in terms of internationalization of real estate, yes, it's happened. It's happened over the last 20 years, with deregulation generally, new tax treaties, Basel rules, end of exchange controls, and yes, it's happened. And and you can see it in terms of the institutional funds that are out there that are kind of slushing between country and country, looking for arbitrage. At the moment, about 100 billion US of funds have been raised that have been swashing from the Americas to Europe to Asia, in that order. There's also core funds that are also doing this, and there's also now the ability for small family investors or high net worth to also do this much easier, lower cost, and the products are available for them. Especially if you see, they're always often the first movers, like the Israelis and the Irish are always the first movers into new markets that open up. For instance, maybe today in Serbia, where you see the Irish and Israelis. While the big institutional funds are a bit slower, they kind of migrate or crawl more slowly. But yes, there has been internationalization of real estate, as well as advisors. Advisors now have become global, companies like Jones Lang LaSalle, which brings me on to the next point, because Jones Lang LaSalle are the biggest advocate in the world of a global real estate cycle, because they sell their property clock to everybody in the world, and so people start to believe it exists. I don't think it exists. I think it's just a function that wherever we look in the world now, we seem to see low interest rates across the globe. And we think because of low interest rates across the globe that we have this synchronization of cycles. It's kind of a metaphysical aesthetic construct that sounds nice, but generally I don't think it's there. The main reasons are because I have to check my notes. Well, the main reasons are if you just look across the world and the performance of some of the larger economies in the world, you'll see that two or three of the largest economies in the world, or two of the top three, are completely acyclical to the rest of the world economy. These are countries like Germany, Japan, where property prices, both residential and commercial, are subdued relative generally to the rest of the world, and where though prices have risen, nothing like where we've seen around the rest of the world. I was thinking about this this morning, and I was thinking, well, if there is a global property cycle, let's maybe look at the data and compare two markets, and what two markets are the other side of the world are very similar. So I thought, well, maybe we could look at Hong Kong and Manhattan, both island city states, or cities, that are restricted by land because they're islands. They're both developed from mainly manufacturing since the end of the 70s to being financial metropolises in their own right. And both have between 100 to 200 million square feet of real estate, 100 to 300 million square feet of real estate in the markets. And if you look at, I collected the data from CBRE, and we found absolutely no correlation whatsoever, while between 88 and 94, Hong Kong was was booming, while Japan and other Western markets were going to slump. And then there were other things like the Asian debt crisis that happened, and there was really no correlation, not very much correlation in the rest of the period between that time. Some of the, you know, the reasons, you know, for this is generally not moving away from this example, but just generally around the world. There's so much diversity between the markets, not in any particular order of salience, but environmental uncertainty, for instance, that you have in Japan, political uncertainty, what you find in Turkey. One of the most important ones is the level of data that you can get in a market. If you walk into a market such as Japan, it would take you years to really understand the market, find data, get comfortable, have contacts. Where you go to a market where you have the information availability of New York, you can trade within a couple of days. So this would create huge time lags in terms of synchronized cycles and bubbles. Also, things like planning between different countries. At the moment, I do a lot of work in Greece, where to get from maybe buying land with no planning permission to getting your final building permits could take you 10 years, maybe with some bribes. Not that we do that, but you know, in other markets, obviously, it's much shorter. But the importance of this is when there's a lack of supply, which obviously drives prices of real estate in a market. It creates structural issues that restrict the rise or the fall in the price of real estate. There are many other issues, construction, how it's done in these markets. In terms of are we facing a bubble? I wouldn't have thought so. We've had 65 years since the last war. In the last 20 years, the world economy is becoming increasingly efficient. All this equity and money that's been built up in wealth is compounding. And the development of the underdeveloped world, money is kind of filtering to the metropolises of the world. And we are facing a situation, we also have a huge undersupply of residential product as well in the UK, as the UK opened up its doors to Central European first wave countries, people to come here, as well as a general transition for people to move to metropolises around Europe. Generally, for these reasons, I cannot see that we really have a bubble, because the most important fact is the demand and supply characteristics don't have it. Obviously, we're in a period of low interest rates. Financing is available and it's much more efficient. The structured finance allows much higher levels of leverage on the assets, creation of products like commercial mortgage-backed securities and other things. So in my view, I think, you know, bar interest rates rising more than 300 basis points, and even then I think the slowdown would be gradual. It would take a major international end of the world event, such as millions of people, hundreds of millions dying with bird flu, or a nuclear bomb, a dirty bomb in Berkeley Square. So, I don't think so. I'll pass over to Brian.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Optimism on my right, and on my left, Brian.
I prepared some slides, but I'm not sure how I'm supposed to move from one to the next.
I shall stand here, yes, as a glamorous assistant.
Okay.
No problem.
Good evening. My name is Brian Sothergill. I've been with Morgan Stanley for about 8 years. The only reason I mention this is because I spent time in the real estate group of three major regions in the world. I started in New York, then I went to Hong Kong, and now I've been in in May I'll be moving back to Hong Kong. So that's kind of my perspective. Real estate. Can we go to my first slide? Real estate in and of itself is an inherently local good. It's not a commodity, it's complex. It's a fixed and liquid asset. There are many parameters that go into considering it. So when you talk about globalization, internationalization, it almost seems to talk to me from the commodity basket, like crude oil or pork bellies or something like that. But it's really a complex asset. You have to consider the location, the type, the size, occupancy, age, tenants, credit quality, et cetera, et cetera. We've all heard the term bricks and mortar. You know, property obviously cannot be shipped or moved across borders like other transit goods. That prevented from being a truly kind of a good that kind of lends itself to globalization easily. And then lastly, transactions take a long time. I mean, real estate transactions, if any of you have bought a house, it takes a while. There's a lot of things to consider. It takes much longer than you originally or initially. And it's not just like simply buying a stock or going to the store and buying a can of jam. Location, location, location. Another phrase that everybody's heard. The most important thing for real estate is where it's located. This also kind of goes against the grain of globalization. How can you have a global product when it's local? And location is the most important parameter of any real estate investment. So all these things make comparing properties across markets and borders very difficult. It's complex. You know, on top of it, you just consider tax regimes, government regulation, specific planning consent regimes, et cetera, et cetera. However, the world has become a more global place. As Paul mentioned, globalization has affected everyone in every corner of the world. And real estate is no exception. Real estate values and rents have been impacted by global trends. Real estate in and of itself, and kind of inherent in real estate, is not something that lends itself to globalization, but there are things that impact both capital value and rent and demand for real estate that are global trends or phenomena. Obviously, capital moves easily across borders nowadays. Reduction in capital controls and regulation by world economies. This affects real estate values. We've seen over the last 5 years an incredible flow of capital to real estate. All the major pension, not all, but almost every major pension fund or schools or colleges or universities and endowments have increased their allocation to real estate. When I joined Morgan Stanley back in 1998, real estate seemed like a very boring, old economy business. Everybody wanted to be in the technology group at Morgan Stanley. In 1999, Warren Buffett went into the real estate market in a big way, but everybody else couldn't be bothered. They were all focused on real estate. Since basically Warren Buffett started in 99, we've just seen a huge amount of capital follow him, not necessarily because of him, but just because when the technology bubble was coming to last, and all this liquidity flushing around the world, given the low interest rates of all the major world economies, looking for a place to go. And real estate over the last 5 to 10 years has been best asset class across when you're looking at bonds or equities or commodities or other type of investments. So there's been a huge push of flow of capital and allocation to real estate. That's had a serious impact on capitalized real estate. Next is people, businesses, both of these have become more, they move more easily nowadays than they used to across borders. And what this has done is this has these are the main factors that go into the demand for real estate, and that had a follow-on effect on rents, which can't be ignored. So real estate in and of itself, is it a global good? It's a very local good, but the world's become a global place, so the factors that affect real estate really have basically pushed real estate into the global arena in a way that never previously had it played. You can just go to my next slide. What this next slide does is it basically just shows you, the sheer size of the real estate market. It's massive. Everybody needs a place to live. People need a place to work. Real estate, it's an enormous asset class. And the amount of security securities that are, the amount of real estate that's in the public market in the form of equity securities is really small. It's a tiny, tiny piece. And you hear all this news and commentators talking about REITs. REITs is a tiny fraction of the investable universe of real estate. One of these global trends we've seen over the last 5 years, I mean, it's really longer than that, but really in the last 5 years, we've seen an immense push for it, is the amount of institutional real estate going into public securities. So one of the trends you can see in the side bullet point there is real estate ownership has been in a huge transformation from the private direct holdings into public securities. Now, you wouldn't know that if you just looked at the UK market, because over the last several years, there's been a huge number of public and private of real estate companies. Morgan Stanley's been involved with at least two. We took Canary Wharf private, and we also took an industrial company called Savile Gordon Estate. And we've worked on a number of others. So GE Real Estate took Hazelmere private, and also took Benchmark, two other property companies, UK property companies. So you wouldn't know it if you only looked at the UK market, but the rest of the world has been moving in the direction of more real estate in the form of public securities. Just in the last 3-4 years, you've seen REIT codes be put in place in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, and France. And there's lots of talk about the UK, and we're all waiting for the budget in 2 days to see what the REIT code looks like here in the UK. And the same thing in Germany, and they've had various discussions about putting their own REIT code in place. So it's one of the global trends that's kind of pushed real estate into the global arena, created the international digitization of the real estate market. So real estate in itself is not a global good, but real estate market, when you put it in securitized form, suddenly becomes something that can be traded more easily, can be moved across borders, bought easily with a click of a button, flow of capital across the border. Next slide. But even still, real estate markets, by and large, globally, are not very correlated. If you look at these two charts we have up here, the NCREIF index is basically an index of private real estate transactions. You all know what S&P 500 and bonds are, these are the U.S. bonds. And then the NAREIT index, which is a big index in the U.S. for the public REIT market. You can see the correlation of the real estate market with private real estate market, with both equity, bonds, and even the public real estate market is pretty small. It's almost pretty insignificant. If you look at the public real estate market, the NAREIT index here, you can see that it is more correlated with the S&P and bonds than say private real estate. But I think that's a function of it just being put into a public form where it gets thrown into index funds and whatnot that tend to get pushed with the kind of ebb and flow of the global equity market in general. One of the other correlations that we've seen over the last few years, kind of global trends, is the synchronization of yields, relative yields. All the new EU companies, countries coming into the EU and Eastern Europe, we've seen they start off with double-digit yields, and a huge flow of capital. As soon as they enter the Eurozone or about or on the horizon of entering the Eurozone, and all the regulation and security from a regulatory perspective that comes with that, huge compression in yields that we've seen in Eastern Europe. So that's another trend that's kind of helped to synchronize, so to speak, cycles. My next slide, I think we'll skip the next slide, is simply on opportunities in global real estate, both demographic and value opportunities. Let's go straight to the last slide. The last slide is basically shows the real estate cycle. And down below, where it says US, Europe, and Asia, you can kind of see different countries are in different parts of the cycle, whether they're bottoming, recovering, expansion, balance, slowing, et cetera. Different places, and even within countries, you've got different real estate cycles. The UK doesn't have a single real estate cycle. There's either retail, office, residential, et cetera. And even within the UK, the greater London has a much different cycle and volatility than the rest of the UK. But what we have seen is a synchronization of these cycles to a much greater extent than ever happened before. It's still fairly insignificant on a global basis when you actually look at the correlations statistically, but we're starting to see correlations that never previously existed. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, fair trade zones or common currencies or basically anything that links the certain regions from a capital perspective or regulatory perspective, leads to synchronization of these cycles. So that's basically what we've seen at, you know, Morgan Stanley in terms of the internationalization of a real estate market. Yes, it's more than it was before, but it's still fairly de minimis in the grand scheme of things when you look at the synchronization of other investment assets. I think I'll leave there.
Thank you very much indeed, Brian. Good information there, but you know, this is as much about you as about us. And questions from you, or indeed points from you, who's going to be pressed off?
Hello, Nina Andriu, DRKW. I've got two questions, if you allow. First one, does it make sense to diversify across countries? Or do you think that if the UK market will go down, then Germany, France will follow suit? And second question is, you've mentioned Germany, I think Chris mentioned Germany and Japan as two markets which have not been as correlated as pretty much everywhere else. But my understanding is that they have taken very different paths to where they currently are, where in Japan the bubble as such has already accumulated and had burst a little bit. And in Germany, I'm not aware of that. What do you think is the future for those two countries? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good questions. I was in Japan in 1991 at the Bank of Japan conference, and one had the sense of if bubbles, you know, I'm not a believer in bubbles, but if you could see a bubble bursting before your eyes, you could see it at that moment, I think. But Brian, I think I was probably more aimed at you than Chris.
You know, does it make sense to diversify across countries? Yes. I mean, just like it makes sense to diversify any portfolio, you know, as we've taught in all our corporate finance classes, to reduce risk and keep the same level or even increase our returns in some cases. So the U.S., the U.K. and basically the Eurozone is quite disjointed in terms of real estate markets. It's very close. You'd think it would be more correlated than it is. But given the different currencies and different levels of interest rates, big difference in the interest rate levels, 200 or more basis. That you see very different real estate funds, different real estate markets in Europe versus the UK. A lot of people are saying, "Oh, the UK is at a peak right now. I'm going to go invest in Europe." So if values collapse in the UK, it doesn't mean values are going to collapse in the continent, because the continent still has a security blanket of very low interest rates. Now, to answer your second question in terms of correlation between Germany and Japan, with the other panelists here, what they think, but I would venture to say there's none, or none that's statistically relevant whatsoever. I mean, Germany and Japan, two of the largest economies in the world, the most important thing to those economies is the real estate in those kinds of countries is how the economy is doing, their interest rate, their respective economy. Relationship between there's lessons learned, sure. Maybe there's lessons to be learned in Japan and in Germany, given that they both had 15-year slumps, but they had 15-year slumps for very different reasons. They had some of the same reasons, but also very different reasons. So I'd say maybe there's some lessons learned, but I wouldn't call them synchronized at all.
Chris, do you want to?
Yeah, sure. It makes sense to always diversify your funds, if you're a UK fund, across different types of assets. Our particular fund, we don't like to put too much into any one country of our portfolio, but we find we do invest all across Europe, but we don't actually have asset allocation that we want X percent in Scandinavia, X percent. We're totally opportunity led. So if we find that 40% of our best deals are in the UK, because we can find them, then we'll do them, and then wherever we find, you know, in the rest of Europe, we'll put the money out there. It also comes down to risk return of each country, and the cost of our equity is 25%, and it's very hard for us in any fund that's an opportunistic private equity fund to find those returns in UK right now, unless you go into large auction processes. So we do find ourselves being pushed further and further into East or into newer markets. And that's been, how to say, the history of funds like ours and as well as MESREF as well, whereby they were focused, well, I think I'm right, but they were focused on the US for the first 5-6 years, and then they moved to Europe, and then they moved to Asia, and that was kind of my point about there not being a global cycle, because the money seeks opportunity and risk return premium markets first, and then when they dry up, then they actually move on.
That's actually a really good point. I totally agree with that. And what Chris has said, basically, I'll just reinforce it, is that you've seen a lot of the same players that moved, maybe started from the U.S., then went to Europe, then went to Asia. The reason why they're moving is because the cycles aren't completely synchronized, because there are different opportunities. And, you know, when the opportunities drop in the States, they come to Europe. When they drop here, they go to Asia, just based on the relative kind of maturity of the but you do see a lot of the same players. Maybe it's the globalization of the real estate players as opposed to the market.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I don't quite know how you distinguish globalization of players from globalization of markets.
Yeah, but But on Japan, there has yields, prime yields there have dropped in Tokyo. Prime assets to about 3%, but when you consider your cost of financing is so low, you can still get a good cash and cash return, especially when you move outside of Tokyo. So it's amazing yield differential between the core, the metropolis in Japan, and the periphery cities such as Hokkaido and other places. In Germany, it's really just taking a recovery play on value, which I think will be driven more by rents than by yields.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Hi there, my name is Ayush. I'm a graduate of the MSc Management in 2000. Just a quick sort of follow-on point from what you just made. It's interesting what you say that funds look for an opportunity in the United States, and then once the opportunity to dry up, then to Europe and then to Asia. And most of the source of that capital is presumably from sort of Western sources, whether it's Europe or the United States. But what would you sort of comment on the phenomenon of sort of the Middle Eastern petrodollars, if you like, and what impact that will have now that they're probably not financing the U.S. trade deficit anymore, especially in the post 9/11 environment. How much impact do you think that capital is going to have in the real estate cycle, whether that's in Asia or the Middle East or whether that's globally?
Mm-hmm. Brian?
It's a very good question. All this oil from the Middle East, all these petrodollars basically from the Middle East from the last time around back in the 70s was basically put right back into the U.S. So it's a very interesting kind of recycling of the same money around and around. This time around, due to the 9/11, war on terrorism, and all the other factors that basically make the Middle East investors less comfortable investing in the U.S. environment, they've really invested back in their own economy this time around. So we're seeing in the Middle East right now, they don't have $1 million real estate projects. Everything's multi-billion-dollar real estate projects. I mean, it's massive. The largest real estate company by market cap is based in Dubai. That's like a shocking thing for most people to realize. It has a bigger market cap than anything in Europe, U.S., or Asia. So that's what we're seeing right now. Massive, massive real estate projects. Probably the most massive projects in the world are by a long way happening right now in the Middle East. And it seems like if you have $1 billion of cash and a patch of sand, you can go public as well. Which is another interesting phenomenon. I mean, there's anything that feels like irrational exuberance right now is there's two things that we've seen. It's guys in the Middle East with a whole lot of money and a patch of sand, but not much else by way of expertise or track record going public. Same thing in Eastern Europe, where you've got maybe a little bit of cash and man and his dog basically in a business plan going public on AIM here in London to buy Bulgarian real estate. It's a little scary.
Yeah. But I mean the effect of the petrodollar is also will have the effect on the dollar, which would find have an effect on most of the investors in these funds, in the private equity funds, are American. I think about 80% of the money is. For some reason, people in other parts of the world don't generally have the appetite for these sort of funds that we're talking about. But certainly, that will have effect in the future of U.S. money with being, you know, wanting to invest abroad, and may retract some funds.
Okay, thank you. Next question, yes. I think it's a good idea to start it here. If you just say who you are and antecedents.
Alok Basu, graduate of Battersea from 1993. I think Brian might have just possibly answered my question to that last response, but clearly, I mean, in your slide, you were covering a lot of international markets from developed world through to emerging world. If you move away from real estate to more general cost investment, one of the key considerations is the sovereign risk exposure one takes when one goes into emerging markets in particular. What are the sort of warning signals that you will look for with regard to, you know, real estate problems in emerging markets?
Okay, kind of two questions embedded in one there. One, sovereign risk, and the other is real estate bubbles. You know, in terms of sovereign risk, this is something that, you know, we've definitely considered. Right now, Chris and I actually just got back from the biggest real estate conference in Europe every year, happens in the south of France, Japan, called MIPIM. And this year, the unofficial theme, it was just obvious, was Russia. Everyone is going to Russia right now. That's the best thing real estate there. But the big question's got to be, you know, what's the sovereign risk? With some of the changes, moved away from democracy that Putin's made over the last, you know, couple of years, what's the sovereign risk? So this is something we asked, and we just opened an office here. Not more exciting, but the real estate group in particular. We have two people on the ground there. But one of the tweets, because we think it's a very interesting market, it's an emerging market, huge market. But one of the things we definitely consider is the sovereign risk. So we would look at this. In terms of sovereign, we look at the same thing as a bond investor who's going to buy Russian bonds. So it's all the same kind of thing. Capital constraint, you know, the chances, basically talking to local experts, partnering. The best way to protect yourself from sovereign risk is to partner with quasi-government or government agencies. You know, make sure you just don't, you know, your government stays out, right? Mm-hmm. If they don't, make sure you get out of there. But that's one thing that we've done to protect ourselves, particularly in China. Our most successful investors have been with quasi-government entities. You know, for a number of reasons. They protect you from, you know, changes that are on the horizon in terms of regulation that might not be that well presented, or might be kind of a surprise to the rest of the market. Quite often we'll find out in advance, usually partner with the local quasi-government agencies. The second question, how do you identify it? I mean, you can always look to ensure some kind of hedge, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the only thing. If you want to go into the capital markets, it's a derivative product, you can do that. That's something to date we haven't done. And to date we haven't had any sovereign default risk that's impacted our portfolio. But, you know, it's definitely something we use in our real estate private equity fund. We do use fairly sophisticated derivative products to hedge currency risk and interest rate risk, etc. Your second question is quickly was on bubbles. How do you spot a bubble? Just like you spot a bubble anywhere else. If something's happening that doesn't look like it happened, you know, this isn't the normal way of things happening, it's probably something you should be aware of. So that's the best way to spot a bubble, is think back, is this the way it's always been, or is this a new thing? So you're trying to say, oh, this is a new way of doing it, and you don't have to be aware of it.
It's got a number of hands that are coming up. There's one there. Yeah.
I'm Sarah O'Connell, and I graduated too long to remember.
I think I came from the days when we still occupied the director's office. But I work for the Housing Corporation, which is the government's investment arm. And we have $3.7 billion to invest in residential social housing over the next 2 years. And so I sort of wanted to ask a local question. The government, with all this sort of money floating around, the government is sort of aware that it's not just social housing which is the problem, but a sort of affordable housing as well. And the government's now looking to work more with commercial developers. It's looking to provide intermediate housing products. The sector as a whole is getting better at raising external financing from the commercial sort of funding markets and things. I just wondered if you had any sort of advice of how, the kind of local question, how you cope with this globalization within a local context.
Right. Globalization. Well, I think the interesting thing, and I know you're referring to Sahara Housing Associations, correct? Well, I know housing associations are becoming much more sophisticated in terms of the leverage. And I think the most obvious way is in terms of the levels of financing that they can actually now get through the global in banks, through using commercial mortgage bank security products, which give them a top rate, a very, very good spread for being inflexible on the terms of the debt, which in terms of the investment period of the housing association is 10, 20, 30 years. So it seems ideal. In terms of our experience with housing associations, we're always a bit confused because I think the whole industry is, because nobody really knows how you qualify for social or affordable. Maybe that's a question I can throw back to you. But I do know about this $3.7 billion that's available in terms of equity loans. Is that right? To key workers from Prescott's office, as well as, you know, that's right, yeah.
Thank you very much, Chris. We've got a fair number of questions. There's one there.
Malcolm Bell, Spending Capital. I graduated from LSD last summer, but I've been investing in that property for quite a while. The first point I wanted to make was relating back to Russia. In my first year at LSD, I was doing quite a lot of sort of property developments in Russia. Definitely impacted on my grades at LSD. But still, I mean, when you sort of refer to local partners in Moscow, partnering the government, it's a very delicate word. I find that the more government partners that I have, the more my problems increase, as well as the sort of fiscal burden that I have on having to pay everyone. That, I think, relates back to sovereign risk, in that obviously, no matter which market you go into, there is an element of sovereign risk in a safer market, more unsafe markets. And what's the determining feature between the two is about return, I think. It's all about yield. At the moment, I reckon you have about 30% of the money in the international property market that has traditionally not been into property. A lot of money has come into the market last 10 years, but most over the last 5 years. Investors looking for yield. They can think they can make more money in property than they can in bonds or gilts or stocks. While having a portfolio, they'll invest in property. Sooner or later, it's going to switch the other way. A lot of money is going to come out of the property market and go back to where it traditionally has been. In the meantime, it's driving up values to a level which is not sustainable. Levels in the UK in particular, I mean, you're looking at a property in Albemarle Street in the West End that I found out during the FIN went for 3.8%. Now, only an equity investor can buy at 3.8% because you can't borrow a level because your borrowing cost in the UK is 4.5%. Margins are becoming so tight, especially in the UK, that UK investors have looked elsewhere. Bulgaria, Germany, Poland, and I think the internationalization of investing in real estate and bubble is essentially talking about a flight of capital between different markets. And as such, because this capital is not all in one market at one point, bubbles are definitely not synchronized. I think the more saturated one market becomes, the capital then flows to another, and then that's where the sort of cycle will lead again. So I think talking about the synchronization of bubbles, it's not possible to have synchronization of cycles. It's not possible to have an international synchronization of one cycle. There are lots of cycles between lots of different asset classes, lots of different investment classes, and international sort of real estate investing has become a lot more complicated over the last couple of years with the development of financial markets, different ways of managing real estate. And so I think so far the discussion has been very general. And we need to really get into the nitty-gritty of different asset classes and different markets to really understand what it is we're exactly talking about.
Thank you very much, Mark. Chris, do you want to come back on that?
Sure. I mean, overall, in terms of, I think you're just talking about how we go into an emerging market. And I think because of all the variety of risks, is that right? Yeah. Correct. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Well, I mean, it's it comes down to really, you know, obviously, you know, it comes down to the what we underwrite at. What's the cost of our equity? So the cost of our equity in the UK. Maybe we might do something for 15%, but exactly the same building, if they say they're both prime, one prime in London, one prime in Serbia, and say in Belgrade, we would probably underwrite that at a cost of equity of 35%. So, and we would do that to effectively price in this sovereign risk, the political risk, the currency risk, and all these things that you talk about. I mean, in many ways, the most important thing you started about local partners. The most important thing, more important actually for investors like we generally, even more often than the asset, is actually the local partner. Are they capable, trustworthy, connected? Because once you go wrong with the local partner, then it's a nightmare. but that's generally how we overcome all these risks. We would price in, you know, the currency on the forward curve. Would price in, and everything would relate back to the cost of equity.
One of the other ways that we protect ourselves from going into emerging markets, like for example, I was in Shanghai buying real estate back in 2003, and one of the things we were cognizant of is there'd only been one or two office buildings that actually transacted in that market. So we were like, you know, we it was an interesting market. We wanted to get exposure. We saw a lot of fundamentals there that could buy, but we were worried about our equity. So what did? We built residential because it's much easier selling one flat at a time. You can get out of it much quicker, much shorter hold period. So that's another thing that we might do. But it, in terms of you mentioned the point about partnering with governments can be a headache. Network rail here in the UK, all kinds of real estate projects. They're just infinite for being kind of slow, bureaucratic, difficult. But there's other, you have to partner with the right company, the right person within the government. Sir Howard Bernstein, who's the chief executive of Manchester Council, he is very well known, he's very hands-on, very plugged in, very commercial and business-oriented. And almost every successful developer in Manchester partners with him. Because if you partner with the city council, he opens doors and he helps to get things. We were working with a developer up there, and they had this big master plan site. And there was one piece of that site they hadn't acquired. They really needed it in order to kick off this regeneration of Manchester. A rogue developer came in and bought it. They knew they could hold them ransom. They tried to negotiate. Our partner tried to negotiate with them. And said, hey, let's buy you out. The partner, the guy who's just holding out the ransom. So they went back to Sir Howard Bernstein and said, Sir Howard, can you help us? Sir Howard went to the guy and said, look, you've got three other sites in Manchester you want planning consent on. You got to play nice in the sandbox. So he did. So he just, it's that kind of stuff where government can really help, be a friendly hand in business and help make things happen and not get kind of held up. Of course, government can also be the opposite as well.
Thank you very much. More questions? Yes.
Hi, I'm Nadir. I graduated in real estate economics and finance in 2003. In fact, I feel that taxation policy and the tax rate of country or local area actually plays a role in determining individual decision of investing in real estate in terms of like the diversification and the choosing of location. I was just wondering what's your opinion in this area, like how taxation rate and the tax policy of an area, plays a role in that area. And based on your experience over the last 10 years or so, who do you think are, which local markets are like the losers and the winners given their tax policy and tax rate?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one of the markets that I'm covering right now, spending a bit of time, is Greece. And the kind of blended tax rate that you in terms of transfer tax, when you buy a building, is about 16%. I think it's the highest in Europe. But that's exactly why we're there, because nobody else is. Because it scared everybody else off. There's also in Greece a 3% tax on income from the property per year, and you know, various high corporation taxes. But there are also ways to mitigate it by structuring offshore vehicles through Luxembourg. Not the 16% tax, but the other taxes. But yes, we have most funds spend a lot of money on any transaction on tax structuring to get the most efficient way to do it. But yes, you're right, it does play an effect, but generally the taxation will be priced into the price of the asset.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, tax is a huge factor. We spend a ton of time on tax and understanding the tax dynamics, putting the tax structure in place. So it's absolutely critical to our investment decision. We're obviously an American firm. You know, we have billions and billions of assets under management in the U.S. Canada, our friendly neighbor to the north, we've made very few investments there because their tax regime is so difficult and so onerous, which is surprising, right? You'd think it's just a hop, skip, and a jump. It's right there over the border. 80% of the population is within 100 miles of the U.S. border. But we've made very few investments there because the tax regime is so onerous.
Thank you. Next question.
My name is Athanasis Metropolis. I'm not an alumni.
You've drunk coffee in Wright's Coffee Bar.
Yeah.
Suddenly I was wondering about the perception that real estate is still a very local market. Now, I suppose I could be able to understand
trying to figure out what your question was precisely, but I think what you're saying is you're trying to disentangle what's purely the real estate fundamentals from other drivers that are not necessarily purely real estate drivers. It might be purely capital going into the mortgage market or other kind of economic factors.
Yeah, well,
you can definitely identify cycles. I mean, in the UK, for example, take retail, for example. Retail again, you have to break it down again, right? You've got shopping centers, which are kind of in-town center shopping centers or major regional shopping centers, or you've also got retail warehouses. But anyway, take any one of them. What you've seen, you see the compression in cap rates over the last 3 years of you know, between 200 and 350 basis points. Sometimes even more, the immense compression, right? And now what we've seen is you've seen basically the cap rate compression on real estate totally slowed down. Before, on retail, you were seeing cap rates compressed by 50 basis points a quarter at a certain time. And now you basically see for the last couple quarters, retail has been fairly flat. Another thing that you see is you see consumer spending slowing down. You see leases. We own a shopping center out in Plymouth. It's becoming really slow, whereas a year ago, it was letting much more rapidly. Now, you know, people wait and actually see how the Christmas sales go before they'll actually sign the lease, even though they've had it for sitting on it for 2 months. They'll wait until January until they've added up their receipts from how the Christmas sales were. So, the retail market, what does that sound? That sounds like, well, if you look at your, you know, if you look at your retail cycle right now, it seems pretty toppy. So I'd say there definitely are cycles. Meanwhile, office, what are you seeing in office? Oh, and also in retail, you're not seeing any rental growth either. Whereas office, you've seen a huge compression in cap rates in office, and that's primarily been driven by two things. People's expectation of a supply crunch in grade A office, say in the city and in the West End over the next couple of years. It's also been driven down just by the general flow of capital into the market. How much is happening in one, how much is the other? It's difficult to say. And lack of other investing, one person made lack of other investing opportunities, basically, in terms of, you know, no one wants to invest in technology, it just goes down, but you can absolutely identify cycles, and you can play those cycles, and there still are cycles. The business cycle will, you know, just like the real estate cycle, will always be there. There will always be tops and bottoms, you're always going to overshoot from both directions. Right now, I would say retail in the UK, toppy. I would say office is in the expansion phase, and I would say that, you know, that residential in London is basically difficult to say that one. It's flat. That one's wholly dependent on where, on two things. In the city, it's wholly dependent on how well financial institutions do, continue to do, and where interest rates go. In the regions, it's more related to interest rates.
Thank you very much, Brian. I mean, you mentioned Ireland, but the reality of Ireland is that it's had the fastest, by a substantial margin, the fastest rate of real economic growth in Europe over the last 15 years, almost continuously, in fact more than 15 years. So it seems to me that the fundamental thing about Ireland is that, as I was saying earlier, it's the real economy which has driven the boom in real estate, particularly given that you had a very, very limited supply of real estate in Dublin, which essentially is Ireland, when this boom started. So you're dealing with a constrained supply, with a small stock, and a rate of growth which is twice that of any other European country. It competes with the Asian tigers. So there is something real there. And I would say it's not so much the construction industry is driving the Irish economy, but it's the other way around. It's a derived demand. The Irish economy is driving the Irish construction industry.
What are the facts?
The Irish economy. Well, I think Ireland
is driving the European bubble. Yeah. Well, they're investing everywhere, but
basically the Irish economy was benefited hugely from joining the European Union. It's one of the real success stories of Europeanization, if you like, and part of that was the English language, which they shared. Initially, were a cheap
offshore English language operating base for multinational companies. But of course, it was also that they'd invested an awful lot in education and investment in university graduates over actually several two generations. But there'd been a diaspora of the Irish out of Ireland because there were no high-paying graduate jobs. But as the Irish economy took off, lo and behold, you had a very elastic supply of relatively highly skilled labour. Now, it's only quite recently that that supply of labour has begun to give out because, you know, a lot of Irish have come back. But they, when they came back, they brought their international networks back with them, which has also helped the Irish economy. And now, most recently, but initially there was a huge backflow of former Irish immigrants who were basically had no graduate opportunities in the Irish economy in the 1970s, but did in the 1990s. Sorry. This is Ireland. Oh, many, many other...
Although they have high stamp duty. They have a high stamp duty compared to London, compared to the UK. It's more than twice as high.
About the macro, the low corporation tax, the role of the state, an economic historian as I was a graduate here, the role of the state is kind of the ongoing thing in the economic history department. The IDA, the encouragement of the tech companies to go to Ireland, they were very, very aggressive of getting the Americans to move their European operations. I think of five American computer manufacturers, four of them had their European headquarters in Ireland. Quite right, Paul, the ongoing education attainment that has been instilled in the Irish people and the support that the government gave to that. I mean, there is more than that. You can say that those are the fundamentals that drove the Irish economy. But, you know, and to say that, well, I disagree with this gentleman that say that it was the construction industry that's driving, or that it might be 50% of GDP. But you're right. I mean, I concur with a lot of what you were saying.
And likewise, the opposite in Germany, where you've
yes.
seen it's just a
yes, absolutely.
Economy.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, we've got time only for one more question, I think. Yeah. Yes, give a shout.
On your point here, it's a fairly scary time to be a real estate investor right now when each of the three major world banks are raising interest rates. We've got the U.S., Eurozone, and then Japan as well. Because what's driven a lot of the profits that Chris's fund and my fund have made over the last kind of few years is that this huge cap rate compression, which has been driven by, inordinately low interest rates. What happens when those interest rates start to pick up? We're going to see a collapse in the real estate sector and the real estate values. It's pretty easy to make a fair case, but at least for the kind of next couple of years, I would argue that the real economy, both U.S. and hopefully soon in the Eurozone and in Japan for sure, and also in China, you're seeing the real economy, which is basically will hold up real estate values over the next few years. And what you see is you won't see cap rate compression. It can compress too much more. I mean, in certain markets there will be cap rate compression, but by and large you will not see the kind of cap rate compression you've seen over the next few years, because interest rates are going to be going up instead of down until the next, next recession. But I think what will hold those real estate values up is a robust global real economy between, a comeback in Japan, which is pretty amazing, what's going on right now. It's continuing robust economy in China. A European economy is just showing sleepy signs of maybe waking up, and the U.S. economy, which is always more robust than the economy has ever given credit for.
Always has been so far. Anyway, we must stop there because we now move on to the purely social side of this. I'd like to thank our speakers very much indeed. Thank you very much for getting on. And also thank you to you and some good questions and got things going, so very nice.
Thank you. While you're leaving, do carry on leaving, but while you're leaving, the reception is in the atrium, which is outside to the left. Can I also, which I meant to announce earlier, there's an alum who is exhibiting some artwork in the atrium for you to have a look at, so do take an opportunity to talk to Richard and have a look at the stuff from Artifact. Thanks very much.